Howdy, y'all. This is Rish Outfield, and this is the Rish Outcast. And you hear that music? Well, wait. See, I was going to play Americana by Kevin MacLeod because it's the big, sweeping Western music I use for my sidekick episodes. But I don't think this works. I don't think this fits. I wonder if there's something else that evokes what this story is about, also evokes sort of a Western-y feel. Well, I mean, if I found it, then you're listening to it right now. Listen to that. Today I'm going to share with you a short story. I don't know if it's a short story. There are all these names. That reminds me of a Sting quote. You know, let's play the story, and then I will go on and on, I guarantee you, about what I was going to say. I'll tell you the Sting quote, and we'll talk about ghettoization. So what I'm presenting right now is called Varkolak. It is a Western-ish story, and was the second one that I ever wrote. First was Birth of a Sidekick. This was written a couple of years later. And as of this moment, I think Big is the only person that ever read it. We had this before the Doonstief came along and ate up any time that he had. We had this tradition of getting together, I think it was like every other week, on like a Sunday night, and we would swap stories. I would read his story and he would read mine, and we would make little notes on it. And this may be, Varkolak may be the last story that we ever did that with. My gut tells me that it was, partly because mine was so long, I think it burned the guy out. But also, yeah, the Doonstief came along and burned everything out. So, as I've said, it's long, but hopefully you enjoy what I'm sharing today. I don't think I have time for the whole story, but take a listen.
Varkolak. Written and narrated by Rish Outfield. Beneath the desert moon I call you. Beneath the desert moon I sing. Beneath the desert moon, so lonely, I'm just a boy who would be king. Sting. Summer, 1884. Seems like a long time ago in this hustle and bustle 20th century, with telephones and motor cars and aeroplanes and street acceptable fashions that only whores wore when I grew up. But it wasn't that far back, really. Not when I think about it. I can still remember that summer, when I was not yet 12 years old, when life was magical, mysterious, scary. My name is William James Anderson, Jr., but not too long ago, I was Willie Anderson, an 11-year-old, living on the frontier of Colorado. This was after a lot of the frontier you read about in the pulps was no longer frontier, and you had to go further and further west to find the wilderness. Which is exactly what my father, Simeon Anderson, did with our family in 1882. We'd had a fairly successful leather working shop in Maryland, but he traded it all in for a few head of cattle and enough provisions to last us a year or so out west. We moved. My ma and pa, my older sister, who was dead not 3 months later, me, and my two baby sisters. Soledad, Colorado is where we ended up, and the first fall and winter were mild ones, so my family prospered, our small head of beef cows turning into a large one, and our small two-room cabin turning into a rapidly expanding four-room one. I wasn't very happy during that time. I'd really taken my sister's death hard. She had been really sweet and really smart, and I was lonely for my friends back in Baltimore. But then I met Thomas. Thomas Porter Jr. was a boy in the farm next to ours. Not in the way that neighbors are today, with shared backyards and communal toilets, but just close enough that I could see when they had a lamp lit, or when Thomas's dad was out with the horses. They had 11 horses, and only one cow, and we had around 60 cows and 3 horses, if you like to compare, though my mother told me that kind of thing was not polite. Thomas and I were best friends by the time 84 arrived. He was 12 and I was 11, and we got along swimmingly. My life was bright for the first time since my parents had uprooted us. It had been a long journey, an exciting one, and the world was nothing but possibilities. That's another thing that seems to have changed in these modern times. Or maybe it's just me that's changed. Anyway, Thomas and I grew really close. I never had any brothers, but I imagined Thomas was what a brother would be like. We played, we fought, we talked, we laughed, and saw each other every single day because we were neighbors. But neighbors in those days aren't like neighbors today, with... That's funny. I started to say neighbors in them days ain't like neighbors today. But I caught myself. That's the way we talked in Colorado growing up. I had formal schooling until I was 9, and then my mother took the job. Back east, they hammered in the correct grammar and proper way of talking. So we'd say ain't and pert near and shucks as much as we could outside the schoolhouse, just so we wouldn't forget how real folks talked. My friend Thomas had to stop schooling altogether when he turned 11, and I wanted to join him, tell my mother that I didn't see the point of all the study and memorization and reading and recitation. But I'd see his red, raw hands in the spring and summer, and red, raw everything in the winter, and was glad I wasn't out planting or picking or tending or tilling. We didn't have much in the way of trees or a garden, and my father was smart about cows and the like, so everyone around treated him like an animal doctor, even though he'd never gone to school for it. My pa wanted me to get an education, though, to be able to read and write and understand how the body worked, so I could tend to animals if I had to, and people if I wanted to. Turns out I did neither. I married the daughter of a railroad man and spent the last 40 years writing up tickets for passengers and booking passage for livestock. I remember my pa birthing cows, nursing 6 sows, and trying to heal lame or injured horses, and later breeding hundreds of chickens in the property behind our house. And I wonder what my life would have been like if I had followed in his footsteps. But I have a fear of animals. I was bitten by a horse when I was 2 or 3. I was feeding him a carrot, and he took a big chomp out of my hand, and charged by a big cow when I was 5. I guess I lost consciousness, one of only 2 times in my life, because when I came to, I was in the house, covering my mother's nice bedspread with black mud. At least I hope it was mud, now that I think of it. And then there was that summer. I don't know if it's even a believable story in this modern age. I want to tell it, because I won't be around forever. I get to coughing sometimes, for no reason. My chest hurts so bad I wonder if one of my lungs will burst. And I haven't told anyone the tale in 20 years, so I might not get another chance. Pa had gone out to tend to a cow on the Timmix farm that had been gored by a bull. So he didn't get to meet them, the strangers that were passing through. That wasn't anything new. There were always people crossing through Colorado on the way to California or Nevada. But these people were really strange. I never heard where they were from exactly, but they had traveled to America from somewhere in Europe. "The old country," I heard one of them say. And they spoke, those who did speak English, with a thick, halting accent. There were about a dozen of them, all dressed in similar clothing, and chattering in some unknown tongue that, to me, sounded like the baby talk both my sisters conversed in when they were taking their first unsteady steps. The strangers had odd faces, with noses that were too pointy and handkerchiefs that they wore on their heads or their necks, despite the warm weather. Especially strange was one, a tall, neckless bear of a man, though he might have only been a few years older than me. He stood off from the others, looking up at the sky or at the cows, as though he'd never seen either. When he looked my way, I was startled, because there was something wrong with his face. His eyes were dim and set too close together, and his face was scrunched up like a mad bull. There was drool stretching from one side of his mouth, down over the kerchief under his chin.
Ma, what do you suppose is the matter with him? With who? That one. The brute,
I said, having just learned that word out branding with my dad and Mr. Shaney from town. I noticed how hairy the big man was, even his hands.
Son, he's just touched, is all. Try not to stare.
I tried, but a moment later he dropped to his knees and began to play on the ground. I approached and saw that there was an anthill there, red ants, and the brute was putting his hands on it, letting them crawl on him, letting them bite him.
Orchek, ne kan pluftane,
a female voice said, scolding. I turned and saw a vision. The prettiest girl I'd ever seen was walking toward him, clapping her hands in a way that was not applause. She was probably 16 or 17, with a pale, unmarked face and green eyes, and hair the darkest brown, hanging back through, yes, a handkerchief. She too had a pointy nose, but where it looked strange and severe on the others, with her it looked exotic and attractive. The brute looked at her stupidly, and I understood what Ma meant by touched. It wasn't just stupid, but some kind of baby in a grown body thing. The girl put her hand on the brute's shoulder, saw what he was doing, and gave him a swat on the head. His hair, a greasy mop of it, was the same dark brown as the girl's. I thought she must be his sister. He grunted, and then pointed toward the anthill, showing off what he had discovered.
Can Drupal Dorchik,
the girl said tiredly. She tried to help him to his feet, but she might as well have been trying to uproot a tree.
They're just red ones. They ain't fire ants,
I said. The girl looked at me with a blank expression, as if trying to discern my point.
They bite him,
she said, and it was English, although accented.
He does not understand.
I discerned she could have used my help, so I said,
we have a new calf. Maybe I could show him.
I held out my hand to him like you would to a child. He reached for it, and I saw ants crawling among all the hair.
Come on. Stand up,
the girl said to her brother, then switched to her normal way of talking.
Banadsto.
The brute just knelt there, either ignoring her or not understanding. I walked toward the fence and pointed to where the cows were ambling, including the weak old calf.
Look!
I called. His dull gaze moved to where I was pointing, and a big smile grew on his face. All at once, he was on his feet, and he lumbered over to my side.
Do you see it?
I asked.
He does unt speak,
the girl said.
English? Anything.
I uprooted some long grass and held it between the fence posts. Soon a cow came over to eat it from my hand. The brute looked at the cow with fascination, drooling again. The mother cow came over too, followed by her new calf. She ate from my hand, but though I gave the big man boy grass to feed them, they wouldn't take food from him. The way he looked at the calf unnerved me. I knew some rich folk back east could afford to eat a calf before it was grown, but we would never waste one like that. This man stared at the animal like Mr. Merrill, the town drunk, looked at the saloon when it was closed on Sundays. I turned to ask the pretty girl what his name was, and hers as well, but she had gone back to stand beside her family. It turned out that only she and one of the others spoke English, and were needed to translate. They were an immigrant family, headed across the plains for Denver or Phoenix, and wanted to buy some milk and meat before they moved on. They meant to be on their way before afternoon came. Also, one of their wagons had split a wheel, and Luke, Thomas's older brother, was going to help them replace it. Thomas's dad was good with wood, and had made the bed I slept in between many barrels and wagon wheels. I had always figured Luke hated his father's line of work, but he was sure being helpful that day with these strangers. He talked with them, and I saw him smile at the pretty girl who had scolded her brother. It wasn't just a friendly smile. Ah, I understood. I watched them, and before long, she too smiled like that. I felt funny. Not jealous exactly, but a little sad. There weren't a lot of pretty girls in these parts, and I'd never seen anyone as attractive as the stranger. Thomas came up to me. He had been off feeding their horses when the strangers arrived, and had found some stalks of asparagus growing by the trough. He handed me one. I asked him if he thought the girl was pretty. He squinted in her direction.
Yeah, I guess. Her nose is like a woodpecker's, though.
A moment later, I heard a cow bellow, and turned to see the brute holding one of its ears. He'd leaned over the fence, and as I watched, one of the beams broke and he tumbled onto his face. The girl, who Luke told me later was called Annalee, ran up, scolding in her funny language. The brute was still hanging over the fence, his face red from blood rushing to it. One of his elbows was in a fresh cow pie. I had my own chores to do, and my mother reminded me of them, so I left the strangers and started off to begin. My sisters found me not 10 minutes later, carrying a big piece of wood between them. They had been instructed to find a replacement for the fence beam the brute had broken, but both were too afraid to approach him. When I went with them to tie it up on the fence, I saw Thomas's brother Luke was still talking to Annalee. She had a strand of brown hair coming down her forehead. He reached over and brushed it back into the kerchief. I'd seen my father do that with my mother, and of course, both my parents did that with my sisters. I knew very little about sex at that age, but I understood what intimacy was, even if I didn't know the word. I felt sad again. But you know, maybe that's just hindsight talking. I finished my chores, but by then the strangers had moved on. I talked to Luke Porter about them. He said they had been eager to get moving, and constantly looking over his shoulder as he replaced their wagon wheel, which brought to mind my father's disapproving glances whenever I set myself to a task. But they didn't explain why.
"Would you have wanted them to stay the night?"
I asked, trying to be subtle. He waved a hand at me, hoping I'd go away. So I did. Thomas and I headed out to hunt for lizards at the old Indian ruins at the base of the hills. It was my absolute favorite warm weather activity, since the nearest fishing hole was a 3-hour walk to the south. Although neither of us knew what we wanted the lizards for. We'd only ever caught one in our 100 or so hunting expeditions, and it bit Thomas's finger, so he dropped it. We'd had no luck snagging one since then. The hills were great for hunting lizards or throwing rocks at snakes. Since we'd moved out to the country, my mother had forbidden me to get near snakes. She claimed to have known a boy who got bitten on the eyeball by a rattler and cited it as the saddest thing she ever saw. At the time, I'd wondered how losing her oldest child was less sad than seeing a neighbor get maimed by a snake, but instead, I'd only pictured it in my mind, and decided that for once, I'd actually obey her. Thomas's favorite activity, though, was to crawl around in the dark. As usual, he wanted to go up to the caves toward the top of the middle hill. He called the big one Dead Man's Cave, from a story he'd read about the Appaloosa Kid or the Lean Rider or one of those. It was a big cave with two entrances side by side, and a long winding tunnel leading to a large opening and a couple puddles of stagnant water. He loved the cave, and to be honest, I suppose I did too. We felt it was our secret meeting place, and we loved shouting in it to hear the echo, throwing rocks to scare the occasional bat that roosted up at the top, and imagining finding pirate treasure in one of the tiny alcoves at the back. My mother had also forbidden me from playing in the caves, any caves. But as that wasn't attached to a gruesome story, it was a command I didn't see any sense in obeying. Because I'd been so late in starting my chores that day, I'd told him we'd do the caves another time, and we concentrated on our lizard hunt, which was, big surprise, unsuccessful. Thomas and I talked about the girl. He called her the woodpecker because he saw it bothered me, and I asked him flat out if he thought his brother would marry her, and more importantly, what he would do with her if he did. Thomas thought she was long gone, headed to one of those big cities where all the populace spoke that silly language. But he chose to focus on the second part of the question and told me what he knew. Apparently, the man got on the woman's back and peed inside her. This was called humping because it was like a buffalo hump. I didn't believe him, but he claimed to have seen horses do it. It actually sounded close to what I had heard bits of before we'd moved here, so I stopped asking about it and started thinking about it. It produced a not unpleasant physical reaction, and I said nothing at all for a while. I was completely and totally jealous of Thomas's brother now, even though I'd only seen him touch her hair. Since I was smaller than him, I thought it should be me who played the hump with Annalie. That night, I heard it. My sisters heard it first, and they came into my little room instead of our parents. Apparently, Ma and Pa had latched their door again. My room didn't even have a door, so they came right in and shook me awake.
"Willie, wake up,"
Jenny said.
"I'm awake,"
I whispered in as unfriendly a voice as I could manage without raising it.
"Elspeth heard a noise." "You did too,"
the 4-year-old insisted. Jenny nodded in the dark.
"We heard a scary noise." "In the house?"
I asked, sitting up.
"What kind of scary noise?" "Outside,"
one said.
"A really scary noise,"
the other said.
"A bear noise."
I didn't believe them. I'd never even seen a bear, so I knew my little sisters hadn't. But I did sit up and look out my window. The moon was round and bright in the heavens, and I could see sky and pasture out there, a few trees, the fence where the cows were kept in. No bears.
"I don't hear anything."
But then I did hear it, a low snarl somewhere in the distance. At least I hoped it was in the distance.
"Hear better,"
my littlest sister said. And I shushed her. I still saw nothing outside, but as I focused, I saw a black shape alongside the fence. It moved closer, and I realized it was just a cow. But then, the cow began to run at the fence, and I heard the snarling sound again.
"The bear,"
Elspeth said, and grabbed my arm. Then I heard a new sound, definitely a cow, but a high, frantic cry. It reminded me of when a calf was being born.
"Tell Papa,"
Elspeth begged me.
"He'll shoot the bear."
We'd had coyotes on our land countless times, but this didn't sound like that. They yipped and whined like puppies. We'd had a wild pig nearby once or twice, but they sounded like my father snoring. Not like this. This was something else. A mountain lion, maybe, or indeed a bear. As I felt around in the dark, trying to find my boots, I heard a distant crack. It sounded like a shotgun or pistol shot from over at the porter's. A moment later, I heard my father's voice, and a lantern was lit. He and my mother had come out of their room, and he practically sleepwalked into mine.
"Somebody shooting?" he asked.
"Sounds like it,"
I said.
"Did you hear it, Papa?"
Jenny asked.
"Yeah, did you hear it?"
Elsbeth asked.
"Hear what?" my father asked, and glanced out my window for a moment before disappearing back into the hall.
"It was a bear,"
Elsbeth insisted.
"I think it was a cow,"
Jenny said.
"You girls get back to bed,"
my mother said quietly. She'd have to ask at least twice more before they'd obey her. Pa glanced at me.
"So, was it a bear or a cow?"
"I don't know exactly,"
I told him.
"There was some growling, then one of the cows started carrying on." "Could be a wolf,"
Jenny suggested. Pa kept moving, getting his rifle from the place on the wall between the two bedrooms. Until last fall, there had only been two bedrooms, until Pa built the hallway and my bedroom onto the house. Next, I supposed, Jenny would get her own room too, probably built onto the back.
"We don't have wolves around here," he said.
He went to the door. I had my boots on by this point, but my mother grabbed my arm.
"Stay inside, William,"
she said,
"and you girls head for bed."
"But I want to see the wolf,"
Elsbeth said.
"I thought you said it was a bear,"
Jenny said.
"You didn't even hear it,"
Elsbeth whined.
"You'd still be sleeping if I hadn't woken you."
"Nuh-uh,"
I spoke up.
"Ma, I'll be all right. Let me go with Pa." "You be a good example and mind me, Willie,"
she said, and expected results.
"Listen to your mother, son," Pa said, and he opened the door.
Bright moonlight lit the sky, and I could see all the way to the new trees outside the cow fence. I considered disobeying both of them, but then my mother started in on my sisters, and I wilted.
"Jenny, Elsbeth, it's 4:30 in the morning,"
Ma shouted, though I never understood how she knew what the time was without a clock. Experience had shown me she was always right somehow, though.
"Now get to bed."
The girls looked at me, and as I started to remove my boots, they sighed and did as they were told. Four of our cows were dead, including the newest calf. Both of the porter's milk cows were dead, too. Mr. Porter and Luke had heard the same sound we had heard. Both of them thought it was a bear. Certainly the cows were torn up like they'd never seen before. All six cows had been eviscerated, a word I didn't learn until 20 years later, and when I first heard it, I thought about those cows, ripped apart with no apparent need for the meat. The porters were more than a little upset. I believe I heard the phrase motherfucker for the first time that morning. Of course, I don't tend to think of dead cows when I hear that one nowadays. They were horse people, and only had the pair of cows to give them milk. My father suggested that they take the most intact portions of the 5 edible cows and try to salvage it for meat. My mother hated that idea, sure that some illness, rabies maybe, would be in the beef. My pa suggested she make jerky out of it, but she was afraid. I guess she'd seen a little boy with rabies once, when she was a girl or something, and it kept her awake at night. She had seen a lot in her day. The porters weren't really interested in eating the meat. What they wanted was to kill the animal, or animals, that had done this. We hadn't had rain in a week or so there weren't any tracks to be found, though Luke Porter did see what looked like bloody paw prints on the rocks at the edge of his land. He said it was too big to be coyotes, too deep to be a mountain lion, but shaped wrong for grizzly bears.
"What about brown bears?"
Thomas asked him.
"Or black?"
"All bears got small feet," Luke said, and I didn't understand that, since I'd seen a dead grizzly back in Tulsa that was maybe as big as a mountaintop, or thereabouts. they walk on the end of their feet. Paws, I mean. They got small tracks, I'm saying.
Then what is it?
Thomas asked.
I don't know. Pa could know when he sees them. Was there just the one?
I asked.
Just one where I saw the tracks.
He looked at me.
Thomas says you were up last night. Did you see anything?
Thomas had slept through everything. He always did. Even the gunshots.
Just the cows, running around all scared.
Apparently, they had heard a ruckus and came outside unarmed. Mr. Porter had seen something near the fence between our two properties, something big and black that he didn't recognize. They'd gone back in to get the shotgun, but didn't see the creature when they started firing. I wondered what would have happened if they had hit one of their horses, or one of my father's cows. Would he have made them pay for it? They tossed around options. Getting traps and setting them up, reinforcing the fence and making it higher, even taking the dead cows and poisoning them and piling them up somewhere at the edge of our properties. In the end, Mr. Porter suggested they spend the night waiting for the animals to come back. Each of the three men on a corner of the fence, each with a rifle. There would be a bright full moon in the sky, so they would probably see it coming from a long ways away. Pa thought the bear would be able to see us from an even longer ways away.
No, bears don't see good at all,
Luke said. Well, animals can smell a lot better than they see, my father said. My friend's brother looked ready to argue, but my dad put up his hands. But it's a good plan, the best I've heard. So that was what they were going to do. After dinner, my father went to bed, trying to get a little shut-eye before night fell. I spent the entire time he was asleep trying to convince my mother that I should be allowed to join the hunt. My biggest arguments were, one, that Thomas was being allowed to stay up and keep watch, and two, that five sets of eyes were better than four. Her major arguments were, one, that she was my mother and she thought it was too dangerous, and two, that she was my mother and she'd already said no. There was no convincing her. And I knew my pa well enough that there was virtually no chance of him disagreeing with her. Even if he did disagree with her, he wouldn't say anything to contradict her decision. And even though it was a girly thing to do, I went in my room and grabbed my blanket and gritted my teeth and cried for about 3 seconds before I sucked it back in and focused on my anger, what I considered a much manlier option. The sun went down and my sisters woke Pa, and I went in and begged him to reconsider letting me go with them.
You said I could come.
Well, that was yesterday.
But you told me you needed young eyes to help.
Really, he said, and I knew my answer just from that. I think I would have gotten an hour more sleep if I hadn't had to hear your mother tell you no about 40 times tonight. She said no, and I say no. And you know better than to ask.
I sulked and hated him and hated my friend Thomas for getting to hunt the monster and nearly cried again. The only thing that made it better was when my pa handed me his old rifle, the one he kept under his bed, and told me to protect the women folk while he was gone. I think about it now, and I wonder, did I survive because I had a mother who worried about my safety enough to defy my father? Or was it just that we had many cows and the losing of three wasn't as devastating as the Porter's losing of two? Regardless, my father went out with the hunting party, as well as Thomas and his brother, and I had to stay inside with my little sisters, praying for the others and practicing my penmanship. And yeah, I didn't do a great deal of praying, mostly because I was so mad at my ma, and at Thomas to a certain extent. They didn't kill the creature. Only one of them saw it for sure, Mr. Porter, and he claimed it was a wolf, though he wasn't really in the mood to talk about it. Thomas might have seen it too,
but there was no way of knowing. He was dead.
Luke had heard the sound from the other night, but nobody had heard Thomas cry out, if he even did. Mr. Porter saw the horses running all at once away from something, a big dark shape that was lumbering slowly toward them. He claimed it was the size of a buffalo. He raised his rifle and aimed it, then said he couldn't see it anymore.
"It's here!"
he shouted, and my father and Luke came running. When they got beside Porter, the animal was gone, either back the way it came or somehow past them. Thomas didn't join them. He didn't answer their calls. They found his rifle, the one he'd gotten for Christmas and been so proud of, even though he couldn't hit a tree with it, and a great deal of blood. His arm was still holding the gun. I never saw the body. My parents wouldn't let me. And all these years later, it's the only part of the story I'm happy about. But it was in the condition that the cows had been. My mother said she wrapped it in a blanket herself, along with the arm. She said he was still wearing the arrowhead necklace my sister had made for him out of mica. Mr. Porter was upset, and Luke was devastated. They put Thomas in the ground that afternoon, and that night they were both up and standing in their pasture, guns in hand, waiting for the damn thing to come back, waiting for the chance to kill it. But it didn't come back. Either it knew they were ready for it, waiting there, or it had gotten what it was after. The next night, they stood out there again, waiting. And it didn't come. No more cows were killed. It rained, but no tracks were found. Luke stood out there 4 nights in a row and never got to shoot at anything.
Okay, I think that's where we're going to end for today's episode. It's not a tremendously long story, but like I was saying, for Big to have to read it all in one sitting, it was tremendously long. He read it aloud, and it cost us our friendship. So I'll come back in a few days with the second half, and hopefully you enjoy it. You enjoy the wait. Enjoy life, kids. You only get the one. So, let's see. Something about Sting. Yes, I have a problem. I started saying this before, and then I realized that I'd be talking for 10 minutes before the story started. I remember back in the 90s, there was this interview with Sting. He had had this stretch after The Police where he did jazz music. And then he was doing stuff that would be considered rock music. I remember he won a Grammy for Best Rock Song for the Soul Cages 1 year. And then a little while after that, he got into country music. And somebody was interviewing him, and they said, why do you keep doing these different genres? You know, aren't you afraid that you're going to lose your audience by jumping from musical style to musical style? And he said, you know, I really resent the ghettoization of music. He's like, oh, this one, this has to be a soul song. This one here, that's new age. This is a adult contemporary jazz combo. I make the music that I want to play. Anyway, sorry, he went on and on about how just the record labels wanted to box everybody into certain places. And I found that with the book industry, with the publishing industry, that there's all these names, all these little subsections. And you've heard me complain before about YA and middle grade and kids and young adults. Well, young adult is YA. New adult and kid lit, I've heard people say. And thriller and suspense and horror and mystery and science fiction and fantasy. And it's irritating that something can't just be fiction. Well, here's another thing, though. I write a lot of horror stories. And when I publish something on Amazon, there is no spot for horror. It's either going to be fiction or science fiction and fantasy or mystery, because there's no horror section. And so with each one that I publish, I have to sort of determine which kind of horror it is. You know, if it's set in the future, well, then it's science fiction. You know, if it's got a monster in it, well, maybe it's fantasy. And if it's a serial killer, then maybe it's thriller. But it's frustrating. And I realize that I'm rambling. You just came here to listen to the story. Well, you're listening to The Rish Outcast, and unless this is your very first episode of the show, then you came here to listen to me. And this is what you get every single time. You get somebody who's driving and thinking and talking and maybe not concentrating, and his mind goes where it goes. It's a burst dam, and here comes the flooded water, and you never can anticipate where it's going to hit. So, the whole reason I mention this is that there are designations for story length. There is drabble, which is, you know, the 100-word story that maybe Monty Python made it up, maybe Norm Sherman made it up, I don't care. There is twitfic, which I know Norm Sherman made up, which is just, what, 140 characters, 160 characters? It's not worth my time to even figure out how many characters it is. There is flash fiction, which I know has a designation between X number of words and X number of words. Then there's short story. Then there's novelette. Then there's novella. There's a novel that's like short, like what James Patterson quote unquote writes and puts out every month or so. You know, some people call them commuter novels, but I know that there's a industry term for it's not quite a novel, but it's more than a novella. Anyway, I hate all that stuff. I hate that I have to figure out how many words something is and then keep that in the back of my mind. That, you know, all I need is 500 more words and I will become a novella or a novelette or an epic novel. I don't know. This that I'm sharing with you today is probably a novelette. I don't know. Maybe it's a novella. I like just saying short story, novella, novel. And what I write a lot of times is novellas. I know there's not a lot of money in that. And sorry. What can I do? I mean, the project I'm writing right now is going to be a novella. And in the back of my mind, a little voice, and the little voice may be many, many authors that I've heard speak at conferences or authors that I know that say, hey, if it's a novel, you might make some money off it. If, you know, if it's a short story, you're not going to make any money. If it's a novella, well, what's wrong with you, kid? There's something seriously wrong inside. The project I'm writing right now, like I said, is a novella. But I keep hearing this voice saying, you know, how much more work would it take to make it a novel? Just a little bit bigger, just a little bit broader. There's enough story here for a novel, isn't there? And that is a really good, nigh unto unanswerable question. I went to a panel recently that was called Short Story or Novel? And in fact, I think it was the very first panel of the whole conference, and the panelists all seemed to agree that ideas are either short stories or they're novels. And you can take a novel idea and cut it down to its bare bones and make a short story out of it, but it will lose a lot. Or you can puff up a short story idea and add all sorts of subplots and meanderings and words. But it's going to feel like a very fat short story. I don't know if I agree with that, but they all agreed. And so let's say that I agree with that. It seems like if I expanded something, we're not talking about something that's just right there on the edge. Like I said, 500 words, 1,000 words, and it would become that other thing. We're talking about something like the project I'm writing right now, which is 10,000 coffins, and it is done and maybe even available. No, probably not available. I'm writing it in the notebook, and everything that goes in the notebook stays in the notebook. It's like Vegas until the divorce lawyer comes around, and then suddenly it becomes public knowledge. But yeah, it's a novella, and I could turn it into a novel if I found an angle, you know, a place where I could say, okay, we're actually going to start earlier and we're going to have more stuff happen. It just, what I want it to be is a screenplay. I still have this passion for writing screenplays, which are about 100 to 120 pages long in 12-point Courier font with a very strict format. And the format is strict because industry standard says one page equals 1 minute of film. And that's why the format is so important with screenplays, so that anybody's screenplay, you can pick it up and say 131 pages. Wow, that's quite a movie you got there. Or 62 pages, that sort of thing. It used to take me a lot longer to write projects than it does now. Partly because writing is much more of a priority for me now in the 20-teens than it was before. But also, I have a little bit more free time. And I don't know. I don't know what it is. In past days, it was such an accomplishment to finish a story. Even if it was like a 2,000-word story, it was great. Because there were so many stories in my wake that I started and never finished. And I think I've talked about this before on the show. I mean, I've talked about everything on the show, right? But I think at one point I sat down and I tried to figure out what percentage of the stories I start do I finish. And I think now, in 2017, it's probably 60% of the stories that I start, I finish. And that's not great, but I would say just 6 or 7 years ago, it was 30%. I'll give you a tiny bit, 33%, a third of the stories I started, I finished. New Year's Day is a novella that I wrote, and just today, I was looking at my notes for New Year's Day, and I think I got the idea for it at the very end of 2001, and I started writing it in 2002. In fact, it was called Haunted House 2002. That was the name of the file for a long, long time, and I had all sorts of struggles with it and abandoned it and then picked it up again and then abandoned it again. And the sad thing is I had abandoned it when it was like 90% done, 92% done or something like that. Anyway, I had forgotten about this, but I'd kept like a log. Every time I would run out of gas, I'd be like, okay, here's what I think is going to happen next. I just, oh gosh. And I looked at that log and it said that I didn't finish it until 2004. So it took me that long to write a novella. And yeah, now I usually get a novella done in a couple of months. 3 months. I don't know. I mean, there are still some that I start and then I abandon, and it's possible that I could pick one up in, you know, 2021 or whatever and finish it. I would love to do that. It would be so cool to know that I started Jeremiah's Blues in 2015, and I finished it, you know, 6 years later. But it takes concentration and dedication, and there's a word for when something is difficult, but you force yourself to do it anyway. I don't know what that word is, but there exists a word. And if that word doesn't exist, then we need to make one up. And I'll start using it on the show the way that once I used Freudenschweide on the show, and that didn't really catch on. Anyhow, I think I will just end the episode right here. We'll come back very soon. I'll give you the second half, and we'll talk about that. Hey, thank you for joining me. I have been Rish Outfield. This is the Rish Outcast, or was the Rish Outcast. Good night.
The Rish Outcast was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license, which makes it free to listen to, share, and poke fun at. But the podcast cannot be altered or sold. The music in this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod, the podcaster's friend. His work can be found over at incompetech.com, also under a Creative Commons license. If you didn't completely despise this episode, why don't you support the show with our Patreon fund over at patreon.com? Every dollar gives me more strength to put Outfield in his place.